police outed me. Nani sniffs and flings the magazine across the table.
Awful! One boy's dead, another ruined his life, and almost ruined yours, and people still treat this like it's a TV show. Thank God for short attention spans. Something else will come along soon, and you can get back to normal.
Whatever that is. It's been about a week since Jake was arrested. So far, he's being charged with assault, obstruction of justice, evidence tampering, and a whole bunch of other things I can't keep track of. He's got his own lawyer now, and he's in the same detention center where Nate was being held. Which I guess is poetic justice, but it doesn't feel good. I still can't reconcile the guy I pulled off Addy with the kid who'd been my friend since 9th grade. His lawyer's talking about undue influence from Simon, and maybe that explains it. Or maybe Ashton was right and Jake's been a control freak all along. Janae's cooperating with the police, and it looks like she'll get a plea bargain in exchange for her testimony. She and Addy are thick as thieves now. I have mixed feelings about Janae and the way she let things get this far. But I'm not as innocent as I'd thought either. While Addy was zonked out on painkillers in the hospital, she told me everything, including how my stupid, panicked slight at junior prom made Simon hate me enough to frame me for murder. I have to figure out a way to live with that, and it won't be by not forgiving other people's mistakes.
You meeting Chris later? Nani asks.
Yep, I say. Lucas keeps eating cereal without blinking an eye. Turns out he couldn't care less that his older brother has a boyfriend, although he does seem to miss Keeley, who I'm also seeing today, before Chris and I get together. Partly because I owe her an apology, and partly because she's been sucked into this mess too, even though the police tried to keep her name out of Simon's confession. It wasn't part of the public record, but people at school knew enough to guess. I texted her earlier in the week to see how she was doing, and she texted back an apology for not being more supportive when the story about me and Chris broke, which was pretty big of her considering all the lies I told. We went back and forth for a while after that. She was pretty broken up about the part she played in everything, even though she had no idea what was happening. I'm one of the few people in town who can understand how that feels. Maybe we can manage to be friends after all this. I'd like that. Pop comes into the kitchen with his laptop, jiggling it like there's a present inside.
You check your email?
Not this morning.
Josh Langley's touching base. Wants to know what you're thinking about college versus the draft. And the UCLA offer came through. Still nothing from LSU, though.
Pop won't be happy until all the top 5 college baseball teams make me a scholarship offer. Louisiana State is the lone holdout, which annoys him since they're ranked number 1.
Anyway, Josh wants to talk next week. You up for it?
Sure, I say, even though I've already decided I'm not going right into the draft. The more I think about my baseball future, the more I want college ball to be the next step. I have the rest of my life to play baseball, but only a few years to go to college. And my first choice is Cal State, since they're the only school that didn't back away from me when I was down. But it'll make Pop happy to talk with Josh Langley. We've gotten back on tentative father-son footing since the good baseball news started pouring in. He still doesn't talk to me about Chris and clams up when anyone else mentions him. He doesn't bolt out of the room anymore, though. And he's looking me in the eye again. It's a start.
Addy, Saturday, November 17th, 2:15 p.m. I can't ride my bike because of the skull fracture and my sprained ankle, so Ashton drives me to my follow-up doctor's appointment. Everything's healing the way it should, although I still get instant headaches if I move my head too fast. The emotional stuff will take longer. Half the time, I feel like Jake died, and the other half, I want to kill him. I can admit now that Ashton and TJ weren't wrong about how things were between Jake and me. He ran everything, and I let him. But I never would have believed he could be capable of what he did in the woods. My heart feels like my skull did right after Jake attacked me, as though it's been split in two with a dull axe. I don't know how to feel about Simon either. Sometimes I get really sad when I think about how he planned to ruin four people because he thought we'd taken away from him things that everybody wants: to be successful, to have friends, to be loved, to be seen. But most of the time, I just wish I'd never met him. Nate visited me in the hospital, and I've seen him a few times since I've been out. I'm worried about him. He's not one to open up, but he said enough that I could tell getting arrested made him feel pretty useless. I've been trying to convince him otherwise, but I don't think it's sinking in. I wish he'd listen, because if anyone knows how badly you can screw up your life when you decide you're not good enough, it's me. TJ's texted a few times since I was discharged a couple of days ago. He kept dropping hints about asking me out, so I finally had to tell him it's not happening. There's no way I can hook up with the person who helped me set off this whole chain reaction. It's too bad, because there might have been potential if we'd gone about things differently. But I'm starting to realize there are some things you can't undo, no matter how good your intentions are. It's all right, though. I don't agree with my mother that TJ was my last, best hope to avoid premature spinsterhood. She's not the expert she thinks she is on relationships. I'd rather take my cues from Ashton, who's getting a kick out of Eli's sudden infatuation. He tracked her down after things settled with Nate and asked her out. She told him she's not ready to date yet, so he keeps interrupting his insane workload to take her on elaborate, carefully planned not dates, which, she has to admit, she's enjoying. "I'm not sure I can take him seriously, though," she tells me, as I hobble to the car on crutches after my checkup. "I mean, the hair alone." I like the hair. It has character. Plus, it looks soft, like a cloud. Ashton grins and brushes a stray lock of mine off my forehead. "I like yours. Grow it a little more, and we'll be twins." That's my secret plan. I've been coveting Ashton's hair all along. "I have something to show you," she says, as she pulls away from the hospital. "Some good news." "Really? What?" Sometimes it's hard to remember what good news feels like. Ashton shakes her head and smiles. "It's a show, not a tell." She pulls up in front of a new apartment building and the closest thing Bayview has to a trendy neighborhood. Ashton matches my slow pace as we step into a bright atrium and guides me to a bench in the lobby. "Wait here," she says, propping my crutches next to the bench. She disappears around the corner, and when she returns 10 minutes later, she leads me to an elevator and we head for the third floor. Ashton fits a key into a door marked 302 and pushes it open to a large apartment with soaring, loft-like ceilings. It's all windows and exposed brick and polished wood floors, and I love it instantly. "What do you think?" she asks. I lean my crutches against the wall and hop into the open kitchen, admiring the mosaic tile backsplash. Who knew Bayview had something like this? "It's beautiful. Are you, thinking of renting it?" I try to sound enthusiastic and not terrified of Ashton leaving me alone with Mom. Ashton hasn't been home all that long, but I've gotten kind of attached to having her there. "I already did," she says with a grin, spinning around a little on the hardwood floors. "Charlie and I got an offer on the condo while you were in the hospital. It still has to close, but once it does, we'll make a pretty good profit. He's agreed to take on all his student loans as part of the divorce settlement. My design work's still slow, but I'll have enough of a cushion that it won't be a stretch. And Bayview's so much more affordable than San Diego. This apartment downtown would cost 3 times as much." "That's fantastic." I hope I'm doing a good job of acting excited. I am excited for her, truly. I'll just miss her. "You'd better have a spare room so I can visit." "I do have a spare room," Ashton says, I don't want you to visit, though. I stare at her. I can't have heard her correctly. I thought we'd been getting along great these past couple of months. She laughs at my expression. I want you to live here, silly. You need to get out of that house as much as I do. Mom said it's okay. She's in that decline phase with Justin, where she thinks lots of private couple time will fix their problems. Plus, you'll be 18 in a few months, and can live wherever you want then anyway. I grab her in a hug before she can finish, and she suffers it for a few seconds before ducking away. We still haven't mastered the art of non-awkward sisterly affection. Go ahead, check out your room. It's over there. I limp into a sun-splashed room with a huge window overlooking a bike path behind the building. Built-in bookshelves line the wall, and exposed beams in the ceiling frame an amazing light fixture with a dozen Edison bulbs in different shapes and sizes. I love everything about it. Ashton leans against the doorway and smiles at me. Fresh start for both of us, huh? It finally feels like that might be true.
Bronwyn, Sunday, November 18th, 10:45 a.m. The day after Nate was released, I gave my one and only interview to the media. I didn't mean to, but Mikhail Powers himself ambushed me outside my house, and as I expected when I first saw the full force of his charm turned on our case, I couldn't resist him.
Bronwyn Rojas, the girl most likely.
He was dressed in a crisp navy suit and subtly patterned tie, gold cufflinks glinting as he held out his hand with a warm smile. I almost didn't notice the camera behind him.
I've been wanting to talk to you for weeks. You never gave up on your friend, did you? I admire that. I've admired you throughout this entire case.
Thanks, I said weakly. It was a transparent attempt to butter me up, and it totally worked.
I would love your take on everything. Can you spare a few minutes to tell us what this ordeal has been like for you, and how you feel now that it's over?
I shouldn't have. Robin and my family had held our last legal meeting that morning, and her parting advice was to keep a low profile. She was right, as usual. But there was something I'd wanted to get off my chest that I hadn't been allowed to say before. Just one thing. I looked into the camera while Mikhail smiled encouragingly. I did cheat in my chemistry class, and I'm sorry. Not only because it got me into this mess, but because it was an awful thing to do. My parents raised me to be honest and work hard like they do, and I let them down. It wasn't fair to them, or my teachers, or the colleges I wanted to apply to. And it wasn't fair to Simon. My voice started shaking then, and I couldn't blink back the tears any longer. If I'd known, if I'd thought, I won't ever stop being sorry for what I did. I'll never do anything like that again. That's all I want to say. I doubt that's what Mikhail was hoping for, but he used it anyway for his final Bayview report. Rumor has it he's submitting the series for Emmy consideration. My parents keep telling me I can't blame myself for what Simon did, just like I keep telling Cooper and Addie the same thing. And I'd tell Nate, if he'd let me, but I've barely heard from him since he got out of juvenile detention. He talks to Addie more than me now. I mean, he should talk to Addie, who is obviously a rock star. But still. He finally agreed to let me stop by and catch up. But I don't feel my usual excited anticipation as I ring his doorbell. Something's changed since he was arrested. I almost don't expect him to be home. But he opens the creaking door and steps aside. Nate's house looks better than it did when I was feeding Stan. His mother's staying here, and she's added all sorts of new touches, like curtains, throw pillows, and framed pictures. The only time Nate spoke to me at any length after he got home, he said his mother had convinced his father to try a stint at rehab. Nate didn't hold out much hope for it, but I'm sure having his father out of the house temporarily is a relief. Nate flops into an armchair in the living room as I make my way over to Stan and peer into his cage, glad for the distraction. He lifts one of his front legs in my direction, and I laugh in surprise. Did Stan just wave at me?
Yeah, he does that, like once a year. It's his only move.
Nate meets my eyes with a grin, and for a second things are normal between us. Then his smile fades, and he looks down.
So, I don't actually have a lot of time. Officer Lopez wants to hook me up with a weekend job at some construction company in Eastland. I have to be there in 20 minutes.
That's great. I swallow hard. Why is it so hard to talk to him now? It was the easiest thing in the world a few weeks ago. I guess I wanted to say, I know you went through something awful, and I understand if you don't want to talk about it. But I'm here if you do. And I still care about you as much as ever. So that's all, I guess. It's an awkward start, made worse by the fact that he won't look at me during my sad little speech. When he finally does, his eyes are flat.
I've been meaning to talk to you about that. First, thanks for everything you did. Seriously, I owe you one. I probably won't ever be able to repay you. But it's time to get back to normal, right? And we're not each other's normal.
He averts his eyes again, and it's killing me. If he'd look at me for more than 10 seconds, I'm positive he wouldn't say this. No, we're not. I'm surprised at how steady my voice is. But that's never mattered to me, and I didn't think it mattered to you. My feelings haven't changed, Nate. I still want to be with you. I've never said anything that matters so much in such a straightforward way, and at first I'm glad I didn't wimp out. But Nate looks like he couldn't care less. And while I'm not fazed by external obstacles thrown my way, disapproving parents? No problem. Jail time? I'll get you out. His indifference makes me wilt.
I don't see the point. We've got separate lives, and nothing in common now that the investigation's wrapped up. You need to get ready for the Ivy League, and I...
He lets out a humorless snort.
I'll be doing whatever the opposite of that is.
I want to throw my arms around him and kiss him until he stops talking like this. But his face has closed off, as though his mind's already 1,000 miles away, waiting for his body to catch up. Like he only let me come here out of a sense of obligation. And I can't stand it. If that's how you feel... He nods so fast that whatever tiny flicker of hope I might have been nursing disappears.
Yep. Good luck with everything, Bronwyn. Thanks again.
He stands up like he's going to walk me to the door, but I can't take fake politeness right now. Don't bother, I say, stalking past him with my eyes on the floor. I let myself out and walk stiffly to my car, willing myself not to run, and fumble through my bag with shaking hands until I find my keys. I drive home with dry, unblinking eyes, and make it all the way to my room before I lose it. Maeve knocks softly and enters without waiting for an invitation, curling up next to me and stroking my hair, while I sob into a pillow, like my heart just broke. Which, I guess it did. I'm sorry. She says. She knew where I was headed, and I don't need to tell her how it went. He's being a jerk. She doesn't say anything else until I wear myself out and sit up, rubbing my eyes. I'd forgotten how tired full-body crying can make you. Sorry, I can't make this better, Maeve says, reaching into her pocket and pulling out her phone. But I have something to show you that might cheer you up. Lots of reaction on Twitter to your statement on Mikhail Powers Investigates. All positive, by the way. Maeve, I don't care about Twitter, I say wearily. I haven't been on there since this whole mess started. Even with my profile set to private, I couldn't deal with the onslaught of opinions. I know, but you should see this. She hands me her phone and points to a post on my timeline from Yale University. To err is human, at Bronwyn Rojas. We look forward to receiving your application. Epilogue. 3 months later. Bronwyn. Friday, February 16th, 6:50 p.m. I'm sort of seeing Evan Neiman now. It snuck up on me. First, we were together a lot in big groups, then smaller ones, and a few weeks ago he drove me home after a bunch of us hate-watched The Bachelor at Yumiko's house. When we got to my driveway, he leaned over and kissed me. It was nice. He's a good kisser. I found myself analyzing the kiss in almost clinical detail while it was happening, mentally congratulating him on a stellar technique, while noting the absence of any heat or magnetic pull between us. My heart didn't pound as I kissed him back, and my limbs didn't shake. It was a good kiss with a nice boy, the kind I'd always wanted. Now things are almost exactly how I thought they'd be when I first imagined dating Evan. We make a solid couple. I have an automatic date for the spring break dance, which is nice. But I'm planning my post-Bayview life on a parallel track that has nothing to do with him. We're an until-graduation couple, at best. I applied to Yale, but not early decision. I'll find out next month along with everyone else whether I got in or not. It doesn't seem like the be-all, end-all of my future anymore, though. I've been interning for Eli on the weekends, and I'm starting to see the appeal of staying local and keeping up with Until Proven. Everything's pretty fluid, and I'm trying to be okay with that. I think a lot about Simon and about what the media called his aggrieved entitlement, the belief he was owed something he didn't get, and everyone should pay because of it. It's almost impossible to understand, except by that corner of my brain that pushed me to cheat for validation I hadn't earned. I don't ever want to be that person again. The only time I see Nate is at school. He's there more often than he used to be, and I guess he's doing all right. I don't know for sure, though, because we don't talk anymore. At all. He wasn't kidding about going back to separate lives. Sometimes I almost catch him looking at me, but it's probably wishful thinking. He's still on my mind constantly, and it sucks. I'd hoped starting up with Evan might curb the Nate loop in my head, but it's made things worse. So I try not to think about Evan unless I'm actually with him, which means I sometimes overlook things that I shouldn't, as Evan's sort of girlfriend. Like tonight. I have a piano solo with the San Diego Symphony. It's part of their high school spotlight concert series, something I've applied for since I was a freshman without ever getting an invitation. Last month, I finally did. It's probably due to residual notoriety, although I like to think the audition video I submitted of Variations on the Canon helped. I've improved a lot since the fall. Are you nervous? Maeve asks as we head downstairs. She's dressed for the concert in a burgundy velvet dress that has a Renaissance feel, her hair in a loose braid threaded with small jeweled pins. She recently got the part of Lady Guinevere in the drama club's upcoming King Arthur, and she's gone a little overboard getting in character. It suits her, though. I'm more conservative in a scoop-necked jacquard dress with a subtle gray and black tonal dot pattern that nips in at the waist and flares out above my knees. A little, I reply, but she's only half listening. Her fingers fly across her phone, probably arranging yet another weekend rehearsal with the boy who plays Lancelot in King Arthur, who, she insists, is just a friend. Right. I have my own phone out, texting last-minute directions to Kate, Yumiko, and Addie. Cooper's bringing Chris, although they're having dinner with his parents first, so they might be late. With Chris's parents, that is. Cooper's dad is slowly coming around, but he's not at that stage yet. Yumiko texts, "Should we look for Evan?" And at that point I remember, I never invited him. It's fine, though. It's not a big deal. It was in the newspaper, and I'm sure he would have mentioned it if he'd seen it and wanted to come. We're at Copley Symphony Hall, in front of a capacity crowd. When it's my turn to play, I walk onto a huge stage that dwarfs the piano at its center. The crowd's silent except the occasional cough, and my heels click loudly on the polished floor. I smooth my dress beneath me before taking a seat on the ebony bench. I've never performed in front of this many people, but I'm not as nervous as I thought I'd be. I flex my fingers and wait for a signal from backstage. When I start, I can tell right away it's going to be the best I've ever played. Every note flows, but it's not only that. When I reach the crescendo and the soft notes that follow, I pour every ounce of emotion from the past few months into the keys beneath my fingers. I feel each note like a heartbeat, and I know the audience does too. Loud applause echoes through the room when I finish. I stand and incline my head, absorbing the crowd's approval, until the stage manager beckons me and I walk into the wings. Backstage, I collect flowers my parents left for me, holding them close while I listen to the rest of the performers. Afterward, I catch up with my friends in the foyer. Kate and Yumiko give me a smaller bouquet of flowers, which I add to the ones already in my hands. Addie is pink-cheeked and smiling, wearing her new track team jacket over a black dress like the world's unlikeliest jock. Her hair is in a choppy bob that's almost exactly like her sister's, except the color. She decided to go full-on purple instead of back to blonde, and it suits her. "That was so good," she says gleefully, pulling me into a hug. "They should have let you play all the songs." To my surprise, Ashton and Eli come up behind her. Ashton mentioned she'd be here, but I didn't think Eli would leave the office so early. I guess I should have known better. They're an official couple now, and Eli somehow manages to find time for whatever Ashton wants to do. He's wearing that moony grin he always has around her, and I doubt he heard a note I played. "Not bad, Bronwyn," he says. "I got you on video," Cooper says, brandishing his phone. "I'll text it once I make a few edits." Chris, who looks dashing in a sports jacket and dark jeans, rolls his eyes. "Cooper finally learned how to use iMovie, and now there's no stopping him. Trust me, I have tried." Cooper grins unrepentantly and puts his phone away, slipping his hand into Chris's. Addie keeps craning her neck to look around the crowded foyer, so much that I wonder if she brought a date. "Expecting someone?" I ask. "What? No," she says with a breezy wave. "Just checking things out. Beautiful building." Addie has the world's worst poker face. I follow her eyes, but can't catch a glimpse of any potential mystery guy. She doesn't seem disappointed, though. People keep stopping to talk, so it takes half an hour before Maeve, my parents, and I work our way outside. My father squints at the twinkling stars above us.
I had to park pretty far away. You three don't want to walk there in heels. Wait here and I'll bring the car.
All right, my mother says, kissing his cheek. I clutch my flowers and look at all the well-dressed people surrounding us, laughing and murmuring as they spill onto the sidewalks. A line of sleek cars pulls forward, and I watch them, even though it's too soon for my father to be among them. A Lexus, a Range Rover, a Jaguar, a motorcycle. My heart pounds as the bike's lights dim and its rider removes his helmet. Nate climbs off, skirting past an older couple, and advances toward me with his eyes locked on mine. I can't breathe. Maeve tugs on my mother's arm. We should go closer to the parking lot so Dad sees us. My eyes are on Nate, so I hear rather than see Mom's deep sigh. But she moves away with Maeve, and I'm alone on the sidewalk when Nate reaches me.
Hey.
He looks at me with those dreamy, dark-fringed eyes, and resentment surges through my veins. I don't want to see his stupid eyes, his stupid mouth, and every other part of his stupid face that's made me miserable for the past 3 months. I had one night, finally, where I got to lose myself in something besides my pathetic love life. Now he's ruined it. But I'm not going to give him the satisfaction of knowing that. Hi, Nate. I'm surprised at my calm, neutral voice. You'd never guess how desperately my heart's trying to escape my rib cage. Have you been?
Okay,
he says, shoving his hands into his pockets. He looks almost awkward. It's a novel stance for him.
My dad's back in rehab, but they say that's positive, that he's giving it another shot.
That's great. I hope it works out. I don't sound like I mean it, even though I do. The longer he stands there, the harder it is to act natural. How's your mom?
Good. Working. She moved everything from Oregon, so I guess she'll be here for a while. That's the plan, anyway.
He runs a hand through his hair and shoots me another half-lidded glance, the kind he used to give right before he kissed me.
I saw your solo. I was wrong that night at your house when I first heard you. That, tonight, was the best thing I've ever heard.
I squeeze the stems of my flowers so hard that thorns from the roses prick me. Why?
Why what?
Why did you come? I mean, I lift my chin toward the crowd. It's not really your thing, is it?
No, Nate admits. But this is a big deal for you, right? I wanted to see it.
Why? I repeat. I want to ask more, but I can't. My throat closes, and I'm horrified as my eyes prickle and fill. I concentrate on breathing and press my hands against the thorns, willing the mild pain to distract me. Okay. There we go. Tears receding. Disaster averted. In the seconds I've been pulling myself together, Nate's stepped closer. I don't know where to look, because there's no part of him that doesn't undo me.
Bronwyn.
Nate rubs the back of his neck and swallows hard, and I realize he's as nervous as I am.
I've been an idiot. Being arrested messed with my head. I thought you'd be better off without me in your life, So I just made that happen. I'm sorry. I drop my eyes to his sneakers, which seem like the safest spot. I don't trust myself to speak. The thing is, I never really had anybody, you know? I'm not saying that so you'll feel bad for me, just to try and explain. I didn't get how stuff like this works, that you can't pretend you don't give a crap and it's done. Nate shifts his weight from one foot to the other, which I notice since my eyes remain fastened on the ground. I've been talking to Addie about this because, he laughs a little, she won't let it go. I asked her if she thought you'd be mad if I tried to talk to you, and she said it didn't matter, that I owe you an explanation anyway. She's right, as usual. Addie, that meddler. No wonder she'd been bobbleheading all over Symphony Hall. I clear my throat to try to dislodge the lump, but it's no good. I'll have to talk around it. You weren't just my boyfriend, Nate. You were my friend. Or I thought you were. And then you stopped talking to me like we were nothing. I have to bite hard on the inside of my cheek to keep from tearing up again. I know. It was... God, I can't even explain it, Bronwyn. You were the best thing that ever happened to me, and it freaked me out. I thought I'd ruin you, or you'd ruin me. That's how things tend to go in the Macaulay house. But you're not like that. He exhales sharply, and his voice dips lower. You're not like anybody. I've known that since we were kids, and I fucked up. I finally had my chance with you, and I fucked it all up. He waits a beat for me to say something, but I can't yet. I'm sorry, he says, shifting again. I shouldn't have come. I sprang this on you out of nowhere. I didn't mean to ruin your big night. The crowd is thinning, the night air cooling. My father will be here soon. I finally look up, and it's every bit as unnerving as I thought it would be. You really hurt me, Nate. You can't just ride here on your motorcycle with all this. I gesture around his face and expect everything to be okay. It's not. I know. Nate's eyes search mine. But I was hoping, I mean, what you were saying before, how we were friends. I wanted to ask you, it's probably stupid after all this, but you know Porter Cinema on Clarendon? The one that plays older stuff. They've got the second Divergent movie there. I was, wondering if you want to go sometime. Long pause. My thoughts are a tangled mess, but I'm sure of one thing. If I tell him no, it'll be out of pride and self-preservation. Not because it's what I want. As friends?
As whatever you want. I mean, yeah, friends would be great.
You hate those movies, I remind him.
I really do.
He sounds regretful, and I almost crack a smile.
I like you more, though.
I miss you like crazy. I furrow my brow at him, and he quickly adds,
as a friend.
We stare at each other for a few seconds, until his jaw twitches.
Okay, since I'm being honest here, more than a friend. But I get that's not where your head is. I'd still like to take you to a shitty movie and hang out with you for a couple hours. If you'll let me.
My cheeks burn, and the corners of my mouth keep trying to turn upward. My face is a fickle traitor. Nate sees it and brightens,
But when I don't say anything, he pulls at the neck of his t-shirt and drops his head like I've already turned him down.
Well, just think about it, okay?
I take a deep breath. Being dumped by Nate was heartbreaking, and the idea of opening myself up to that kind of hurt again is scary. But I put myself on the line for him once when I told him how I felt about him, and again when I helped get him out of jail. He's worth at least a third time.
If you'll admit that Insurgent is a cinematic tour de force and you are dying to see it, I'll consider your proposal. Nate snaps his head up and gives me a smile, like the sun coming out.
Insurgent is a cinematic tour de force, and I'm dying to see it.
Happiness starts bubbling through me, making it hard to keep a straight face. I manage, though, because I'm not going to make things that easy on him. Nate can sit through the entire series before we leave the friend zone.
That was fast, I say. I expected more resistance.
I already wasted too much time.
I give a small nod. All right, then. I'll call you. Nate's smile fades a little.
We never exchanged numbers, though, did we?
Still have your burner phone? I ask. Mine's been charging in my closet for 3 months, just in case. His face lights up again.
Yeah, I do.
The gentle but insistent honk of a horn penetrates my brain. Dad's BMW idles directly behind us, and Mom lowers the passenger window to peer outside. If I had to use one word to describe her expression, it would be resigned. There's my ride, I tell Nate. He reaches for my hand and squeezes it quickly before letting go. And I swear to God, actual sparks shoot across my skin.
Thanks for not telling me to get lost. I'll wait to hear from you, okay? Whenever you're ready.
Okay. I move past him toward my parents' car and feel him turn to watch me. I finally let myself smile, and now that I've started, I can't stop. That's okay, though. I catch his reflection in the backseat window, and he can't either. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of One of Us is Lying by Karen M. McManus. Bronwyn was read by Kim I. Guest. Cooper was read by McLeod Andrews. Addie was read by Shannon McManus. Nate was read by Robbie Damond. This program was directed by Olivia McKenzie Smith. Executive producer, Kelly Gilday. Text copyright 2017 by Karen M. McManus. Production copyright 2017, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.